from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Parents of students coming from some of suburban Chicago's most affluent high schools are legally giving up their kids to get financial aid.
The parents are, some of them are doctors, lawyers, real estate agents.
A ProPublica Illinois investigation discovered dozens or more cases where parents hire lawyers to petition the court to turn over guardianship to a friend or relative so the student can be declared financially independent and qualify for financial aid.
Shame on them. Shame on them. I mean, the idea that people who could afford to send their children to college are nevertheless taking public resources away from, because we have a limited amount of money in our MAP grant program. We've increased that just this year, but there's still a limited amount. There are more people applying for monetary assistance program money than there are dollars that we can provide. So if people are defrauding the system, these wealthy parents are literally committing fraud here. We need to go find them, root it out, and make sure that those dollars go to the right people.
Well, some wealthier parents using a loophole to get their kids' college financial aid. Apparently that caught several officials by surprise. We'll discuss that. Also, questions surrounding the spouse of a state representative who spearheaded marijuana legislation this year, the spouse having now been hired by a marijuana company. And as we come on to broadcast this show, a sitting state lawmaker has been indicted. We'll have that and more here on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House Editor in our State House studio today. And he's joined by Doug Finke, who covers state government for Gatehouse Media and several newspapers here in the state of Illinois. And Doug, it's good to have you on once again.
Good to be here.
Brian, I'll go to you first. This state lawmaker and the indictment we're talking about, this is Senator Tom Cullerton. He's a Democrat from DuPage County. And give us the update of what we know at this time.
Yeah, he's a, like you said, Democratic senator from Villa Park. He was elected back in 2012 after the remap process. And he is basically being charged with falsely collecting money from the Teamsters Union, where he used to work and apparently still works. But the question is, was he actually working or just sort of getting money from them for not working? And it's both the Teamsters Union itself as well as its pension fund. Now, one of the background elements here that seems like it's not coincidental is that just this week, the Teamsters Union president pleaded guilty, John Coley, former president now, local Teamsters Union president, and seems to be cooperating with the feds. They asked for a delay in sentencing so that he could continue cooperating. Lo and behold, a couple days later, we have this indictment of a state senator.
Now, we know what the indictment has to say. We've just been trying to go through that and get a better understanding. But at this time, Cullerton remains a sitting member of the state legislature.
Yeah, as we go to air Friday morning, he does. And like you said, we can just read from it here. It's accusing him of embezzling. Well, it says that he embezzle, steal, and unlawfully and willfully abstract and convert to his own use the monies, funds, property, and other assets of a labor organization, namely Teamsters Joint Council 25. So, I mean, that's a lot of legalese, but the basic gist of this is that he is being accused of theft. Now, his attorney, as I saw a statement posted online to another news organization, that his attorney says, this is just that union president trying to save his own skin by pointing the finger at an associate, and they deny all the charges and says they'll fight them.
Charlie, I don't want to try to draw too many comparisons to other cases and such, but lawmakers and unions in Illinois, they go far back. This is there's been connections there for years.
Yeah, if you look at Illinois' history, going back, the ties between labor and the political parties, earlier Republicans, now mostly Democrats, have always been an admixture where union officials would be elected to the legislature. Lawmakers would have side jobs with union organizations. For some of the unions, there was also the influence of the Chicago Mafia, you know, organized crime. So it's been a kind of a tawdry history if you look at it from that angle. And lawmakers getting in trouble, there's been a host of those. And again, it's a bipartisan thing. People going to prison for doing things like changing the rules on weight limits for trucks to benefit the trucking industry. I believe it was the cement trucks in particular, and people from both sides, yeah, Republicans and Democrats, being paid off to do that. And if I'm not mistaken, there's been dozens of legislators who've committed these kinds of crimes. Not that Senator Cullerton is guilty, as I guess as Doug said, this could be a guy who's already got the feds on his case and he's looking for ways to lessen the burden on him and get maybe a lighter sentence by pointing the finger at a lot of other people. But yeah, and the notion of somebody in the legislature having a, quote, part-time job where the work requirement is 0 hours a week, that's nothing new either. That used to be fairly common, and it used to be generally they would be political jobs. In Cook County, they would be Democrats working for the county or working for the city. In DuPage County, they'd be Republicans working for the county or some of the local communities. It's part of our DNA in Illinois.
Kind of what they used to call or have been calling ghost payrolling.
Yeah.
So, go ahead, Doug.
Well, I was just going to say part of the indictment mentions that there was a stipulation that this job that Cullerton allegedly had with the Teamsters required him to put in at least 30 hours a week at it in order to qualify for compensation. So if it's not a matter that they were just, I guess, being generous with him, he wasn't fulfilling whatever the requirements were from the Teamsters to collect this
money. Of his contract.
And the other one other thing I just point out that I thought was kind of interesting, that prior to being elected to the General Assembly, Cullerton was a member of the Teamsters. The job that he had at that time, he was required to give it up, apparently, or at least he did give up his union membership when he was elected to the Senate, and then had this arrangement where he was still collecting money from them.
And I want to be clear, too, because there were two Cullertons in the Illinois Senate. There is Tom Cullerton, who we're talking about here, and then, of course, the Senate President, John Cullerton. And Brian or Doug, if you can clarify the relationship between the two.
They're distant cousins, okay, is the way they've always been described.
And again, Brian, I'll leave it to you if there's anything else we should know at this point. Again, we're just trying to get this information, as we sit down to record here as well, but anything else we should know about this case?
Yeah, the last thing I'd say on it is it's not a small amount of money that we're talking about. The indictment alleges a total loss of $274,000. That's not just salary, but also health and pension plan payments and things like that.
Well, we've been following here as well over the last several weeks an investigation that apparently has been taking place, federal investigation, and it's been tied to people who have some type of connection to the Illinois House Speaker, State Democratic Party Chairman Michael Madigan. We're still not quite sure what is going on with that. There have been raids on people's homes. There was some discussion about payments being made to a former aide of the Speaker, and we don't know, again, at this point, exactly where that's at. But I also wanted to get into this week that Michael Madigan is also the subject of a lawsuit. He's sort of the target of that is going on right now. And this week, Brian, his attorneys in the case gave a response to the lawsuit. You fill us in on what's going on there.
Yeah, basically, they're saying, you know, the one of the main charges here is that Madigan is this all-powerful, you know, Wizard of Oz character who is influencing people with his position of power, not only in his government position as Speaker of the Illinois House, but also his political party position as Chairman of the Illinois Democratic Party. And to, you know, quote from the response that the Madigan's attorneys filed with the court. It says, you know, defendants dispute that defendant Madigan uses the numerous roles he holds to influence Democrats at all levels of state government. The evidence cited does not support this statement, nor does the record otherwise support a statement. And so basically they're saying, well, you want to say that I'm all powerful, prove it. And I think this is sort of interesting because it sort of dovetails with that other investigation of Madigan and his people. And I think we talked about this a few weeks ago where one of the Madigan aides who had been fired for allegedly for, sexually harassing an employee, a lower level campaign staffer in one of his political organizations, had been getting apparently has been getting monetary help. And one of the questions is, did Madigan order that? Well, I think a lot of people think probably not, because it's actually been bad for him politically. But this machine, you know, there's a hypothesis out there that the Madigan machine is so well oiled that he doesn't really have to give orders. He doesn't really have to flex his muscles anymore. He has built an aura around himself, and people sort of accept that he is all powerful. And so it's interesting that now that, you know, his attorneys are trying to put before the court, I think, this question of, well, what evidence do you really have that I am this all-powerful person? As a former colleague of ours named Chris Wetterick once put it, people sort of view him as this combination of Gandalf and Emperor Palpatine. Two pretty deep nerd references there for our listeners. But yeah, so it's an interesting argument. We'll see where it goes. I'm not as powerful as you say.
Charlie, I mean, he holds these two roles. They are powerful positions. So is this just sort of a smokescreen? I mean, he does have influence. He does have power. But get your thoughts on this.
Yeah, well, it occurs to me, I suppose it depends on how do you define influence. Does Madigan make personal calls to everybody and say, do this, do that, do the other thing? Or are other people in the organization who understand what his philosophy is and where he's coming from, do they make those calls or make those suggestions? Now, obviously, he's the head of the Democratic Party. Part of his job as head of the Democratic Party is to try and find candidates who can win and then work to get them elected. I mean, that's what being the party leader is all about. So I personally don't think there's much merit in the lawsuit. The notion that well, he puts up these sham candidates. Well, if you look at the facts, in that particular district, had it only been Madigan and his challenger, Madigan would have won with roughly 2/3 of the votes.
Doug, let me go to you on this, because that, I think, is something maybe people don't quite understand, this idea of putting up a candidate to basically run against you in a primary. The reason, at least, that's being alleged here of why somebody would do that. Can you fill us in?
Right. The person who's bringing this lawsuit is a gentleman named Jason Gonzalez. And the allegation is that Madigan put up two other candidates with Hispanic surnames to dilute the vote, because Madigan's House district has become very heavily Hispanic over the years. So the idea is that if he has a Hispanic challenger or one with a Hispanic surname, you know, if all the voters flock to them, possibly Madigan could be defeated. So you put up candidates with multiple Hispanic surnames, so with the idea of diluting the vote, spreading it out among several people. But as Charlie pointed out, in this case, even if all of the votes that weren't going to Madigan had gone to this one challenger instead, he still would have been clobbered. So if Madigan did put these people up, it was an exercise that wasn't necessary.
And Charlie, this idea of sham candidates, as they want to call it, but this has been out there for a while. This has happened throughout the years where people would be put on the ballot to sort of dilute the vote.
Yeah. And it's kind of common practice. It's not anything that's, what would you say, brand new. Oh, this is a great new idea that the Madigan team came up with. I don't want to get into all the specifics, but this has been not at all unusual over the years.
Brian, go ahead. I think you wanted to get in there.
No, I was just going to say that I think it's important to recognize or remember the context in which this campaign against Speaker Madigan was being waged. Madigan was alleging that, and I don't remember what the evidence for this was, so I don't want to speak too far out about this, but that Gonzalez was being put up by Bruce Rauner, who made it his mission at the beginning of his term to try and undermine Speaker Madigan at every opportunity and dispatch with him if he could. So I think in the sort of the atmosphere of total war back then, it was viewed as, I think, from the Speaker's perspective, although far be it for me to say what was in his head, but I think Democrats would say, look, they were in a total war with Governor Rauner. And the Speaker certainly was in an existential battle with him and felt like just about everything is fair in those circumstances.
Let me turn to another issue that's certainly got some headlines this week. And this involves, and this is a ProPublica Illinois investigation that uncovered this, parents, apparently in some cases wealthier parents, turning over guardianship of their teens to like a friend or a relative. And so the student then would be able to declare what's known as financial independence and qualify for tuition aid, scholarships from college. So, you know, they would not be able to qualify for those without this type of maneuver, this taking advantage of this loophole. And Brian, this is getting a lot of attention this week.
It sure is. Yeah, this is a story that apparently you, just as a brief aside, as a journalist, you feel bad because ProPublica and the Wall Street Journal were apparently pursuing the same story. ProPublica Illinois had it out a couple hours ahead of time, but the Wall Street Journal ended up actually talking to a family. And, you know, this is just one example of this, but there was a 17-year-old woman who, you know, her mother told the Journal that, you know, their income is over $250,000 a year, which in the Chicago area is at least in the top 10-15%. That's pretty good. But they've spent $600,000 putting older kids through college, don't have equity in their home, and said that they really felt tapped out to pay for another college. So she transferred guardianship of her daughter to a business partner. Again, this is from the Wall Street Journal report. And now the daughter goes to a private school on the West Coast. It's $65,000 a year in tuition. And she gets $27,000 in merit scholarship, which you imagine she would have gotten anyway, even with wealthy parents on paper, but she's also getting $20,000 in need-based financial aid, including a federal Pell Grant. And that is what really has people's backs up here. The Federal Department of Education is rewriting its rules now. Governor Pritzker says that he's calling for an investigation. We've heard from U of I officials that they were made aware of this by some high school guidance counselors who saw students getting need-based scholarships and thought, well, that seems odd. That person isn't what I would call needy. And so this is something, it's if not quite on the level of national outrage that the college admission scandal of the actresses and elite, you know, the people who are fake members of the rowing team at some elite schools that we had within the last year. It is another example of people who are in the upper income brackets taking advantage of the system. And, you know, I don't want to go on too long here, but we should talk. MAP grants are a limited thing in Illinois.
Yeah, I was going to say that. This is a situation here, Doug, this amount of money is limited, and it's not something that, you know, that if one kid takes it, that there's plenty left for the others who really do need it. This is a situation where, you know, you're taking away from people who are truly needy for this.
Well, literally in this case, and there is a waiting list, as I understand it, of thousands of kids who would qualify for MAP grants if there was sufficient money allocated to them. But even though the legislature approved more money for MAP grants in the most recent budget, there still isn't enough to cover everyone who has applied for it and has a need for it. So if some of this money is being taken by people whose families are financially well off by, I think, most anybody's definition, and some kids from families who definitely are not financially well off are being left out in the cold, that's what, as Brian said, has people's backs up. And just one addition, I believe, was it the House has announced that they are going to hold hearings very soon on this issue. So that means very likely will be seeing some legislation if there's something to be done address this issue.
And Charlie, get your thoughts on this since you deal with students on a regular basis.
Yeah, and it's, as you pointed out, the disgrace in this is that if I'm some multimillionaire and I don't want to foot the bill for my kids' college tuition and I pass guardianship off to my brother who's also a multimillionaire, then when my student or my kid applies for financial aid and fills out what his income is, the only income that counts is the couple thousand dollars he made during the summer working at the park district, and that's his income. The guardian family's income doesn't come into the equation at all, nor does his own family, because his own family is no longer responsible for him. And that is a loophole, and I think probably that's, of all the things we've talked about today, the Cullerton scandal, the Madigan deal, the one that probably would upset most people the greatest is this, where the very wealthy families are using the way the law is structured to take advantage of that, to get their kids qualified for financial aid that otherwise would have gone to somebody who's not so well off.
And the public's view of politicians so low anyway that this is something that really gets their dander up.
Oh, well, so what else is new?
And before I move on, Brian, just real quick, do we know just how common this is? I can't imagine it's that common, but it does apparently happen.
Yeah, and I was trying to figure that out from reading the stories, and I think that the truth is we just don't know. So ProPublica Illinois, which had one version of this story, found more than 40 of these guardianship cases fitting this profile, their story says. And that's from January of last year, January 2018, through this June, just in Lake County. Now, that is a pretty wealthy area, county north of Chicago, but if you multiply it across the state, I mean, I don't know if we're talking about scores of cases, maybe hundreds, but there was a person in that sort of suburban area who was sort of coaching people on this scheme. So I think the truth is we really don't know that yet. And there are obviously thousands of kids in Illinois who go to college either here or out of state every year. I do think there's one other thing we should mention here, which is the broader context in which this comes, and that is college has gotten really expensive everywhere in the country, but especially in Illinois. I mean, compared to when I went to school a couple of decades ago, it's much, much more expensive. And as the Board of Higher Ed has pointed out in their budget presentations for the last few years, they're one of the few aspects of higher education, is one of the few areas of state government where operational funding has actually lower, it's actually lower now in inflation-adjusted terms than it was in the year 2000. Almost everything in state government has at least tried in some way or another to keep up with inflation, but that is actually, we're spending less money, state dollars, for higher ed operations now than we are, than we were in 2000. Now, some critics would say, well, that's because our pension payments have grown so much, and if you count the pension payments, Illinois is actually reasonably keeping up with higher ed costs. It's just more of that money is going to make up for past shorting of the pension system. But the fact remains is that in terms of the money the state gives for operating its public universities, that is a lot lower, and we have seen tuition rise as a result.
Well, let me move on here just the last couple of minutes or so. Another story that got some attention this week involves the spouse of a state representative. The representative we're talking about is Kelly Cassidy, married to Candace Gingrich. That name might be familiar to you. She is the sister of the former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Well, Cassidy was heavily involved, Doug, in the marijuana legalization legislation that passed this year. And now we find out that Gingrich is taking a pretty high-powered job with a marijuana company. And there's some people who are drawing some line there of connection, saying, well, here's somebody who played a really key role of leading this legislation through, and now her family benefiting from it.
Right. The Candace Gingrich is getting a job with a company that in Florida involved with cannabis. However, it's actually a sister company, satellite company, to an operation here in Illinois that is involved in the marijuana business and will benefit the fact that the marijuana has been legalized for recreational use. Cassidy said that this was all cleared with the ethics people, that they didn't see any problem with it. However, the Chicago Sun-Times, which did a story on this, also editorialized that the visuals on this are absolutely awful, and that Cassidy has pretty much wrecked her credibility as far as carrying this issue any further, and should basically step away from it. So we'll see how this plays out. I think the Sun-Times is probably right. There's one thing that by the strict letter of the law, it might have been all right, but maybe it doesn't look very good in the end.
And Charlie, just about a minute here, but if you want to respond to that, has she wrecked her credibility with this this move that's happened here?
Well, I think it was probably disappointing to a lot of the people who rallied around this issue, and it does look bad. Now, the explanation that's given is that Candace is not going to be involved in any way, shape, or form with the Illinois operation. She's going to be focusing all her attention on Florida. But nonetheless, the optics don't look good.
Mm-hmm. And again, from what we have heard, at least from Cassidy, saying that there were no ethical violations, that they had run this past the ethics departments there and the inspectors to get a look at this beforehand. So we'll continue to follow that and see if there's any fallout from it.
Yeah, but I would add, though, even though the ethics people say, oh, sure, that's okay, sometimes you have to take a look and say, well, what's the impression going to be on the general public, and what opportunities might this afford people who are opposed to what I stand for to attack my issues based on this question of the optics of my spouse getting this job?
Okay. Let's move on to our notes from the field. Brian, let's start with you.
Yeah, this is more... law signings this week. The governor still has, I think at last check, more than 400 bills on his desk awaiting his signature or rare occasions a veto. But the ones he signed this week is going to ban companies from asking for salary history. This is a move that has been pushed by champions of women's rights. They say that women in particular, because there has been historic discrimination in pay for women, that they often start out at a lower salary than they might otherwise, and that if you have to disclose your salary when you go from job to job, that can compound your economic losses over the course of a lifetime. From here on out in Illinois, companies are not able to ask about salary history.
Okay. Doug?
It was a red letter week for the state of Illinois. Fitch Ratings, which is one of the bond rating agencies, upgraded the state's outlook from negative to stable. Let's three cheers for that. The state's bond rating is still just above junk status, but at least it's not in danger of immediately sinking further, apparently.
Okay. And Charlie?
Well, kind of following up on what Doug said, Professor Geertz at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the U of I came out with a flash index, and it showed that after 2 months of slight decline, the index bounced back to 105.4 in July from 105.2 in June. And Professor notes, July 2019 marked the longest expansion in U.S. history going back to the 1850s.
That will do it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Doug Finke. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.